the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Hello and welcome to this August 18th, 2011 edition of Education Now. I am your host, Athena Melville, and in this report, I will focus on public education in America today. As I see this great controversy developing in public education, I see the greatest problem through my research is standardized testing. When I left the public education system and took my children out in 1980, it was because I saw what was happening to a system that was second only to New York. I live here in California. It was second only to New York in the nation, and its universities are world-renowned. So it was difficult for me because I really believed in public education. So I've always followed closely the events occurring and happening in public education because I believe in public education. I believe in a public education system that is open to all ethnicities and cultures and does not ask the child to come to school and leave that ethnicity or culture behind. I believe in a public school system where all this variety and diversity of ethnicity coexists and learns about one another from this diversity. I believe in a public education system that is a clear separation of church and state. The idea that America is only comprised of Christians is so offensive to me, and I think it must have been to those who wrote that there should be a separation of church and state. And so those are my feelings about public education, and the public education system would reflect the latest research in human growth and development. And that is another thing that is essential in public education. And what is being done in public education today is breaking two of those essential elements of public education: a separation of church and state, and a based in the what we know about human growth and development from experts in the field. We have spent a fortune on this research, developing it, and yet we are not putting it into practice in our public education system. Something is terribly wrong. And I find that it really starts with the entire concept of standardized testing. When standardized testing was introduced into the system, it was not, of course, the way that it is today. And so the first thing that I'm going to do is read to you from an article on test-based incentives that don't produce real student achievement by Valerie Strauss from the answer sheet in the Washington Post, May 20th, 2011. And You know, in this report by Valerie from the Washington Post, from the answer sheet, I think you can see why it's such a total catastrophe. You also should know that it did not, standardized testing is not used in the nations that have the top, they get the top coming, you know, as number one in the very top of what's, you know, best education systems in the world. In those systems, they don't use standardized testing. In those systems, teachers are paid very well so that you're not losing the best of them. In those systems, they follow the child. In those systems, it's a low student-faculty ratio. So, now let's go on with what we're doing to our children and what we've done to our system since 1980. And this is report, again, is from Valerie Strauss at the Washington Post, the answer sheet. Incentive programs for schools, teachers, and students aimed at raising standardized test scores are largely unproductive in generating increased student achievement, according to a new report researched by an expert panel of the National Research Council. The report said that standardized tests commonly used in schools to measure student performance, including high school exit exams and tests in various grades mandated by former President Bush's No Child Left Behind law, fall short of providing a complete measure of desired educational outcomes in many ways, according to a summary of the lengthy document. The report, together with a number of other studies released in the past year, effectively serve as a warning to policymakers in states that are moving to implement laws, with support from the Obama administration, to make teacher and principal evaluation largely dependent on increases in student standardized test scores. The practice doesn't bring about the kind of student achievement policymakers say is necessary for the United States to compete with the highest performing countries, according to the 17-member Committee of Incentives on Incentives and Test-Based Accountability, covered by the National Research Council, which is the research arm of the national academies, including the National Academy of Sciences, and the National Council of Engineering, and the National Academy of Medicine. The panel, as to include experts in assessment, education, law, and the sciences, examined over the past decade 15 incentive programs, which are designed to link rewards or sanctions for schools, students, and teachers to student test results. The program studied included high school exit exams and those that give teachers incentives, such as bonus pay for improved test scores. The panel studies the effects of incentives, not by tracking changes in scores on high-stakes tests connected to incentive programs, but by looking at the results of low-stakes tests, such as the well-regarded National Assessment of Educational Progress, which aren't linked to the incentives and are taken by the same cohorts of students. The research concluded that the effects of incentive programs tend to be small and effectively zero for a number of such programs. Gains that were declared, that were detected, were concentrated in elementary grade mathematics and are small in comparison with the improvement the nation hopes to achieve, according to the summary. The researchers concluded not only that incentive programs have not raised student achievement in the United States to the level achieved in the highest performing countries, but also that incentive sanctions can give a false view of exactly how well students are doing. The U.S. reform movement doesn't follow the same principles that have been adopted by other countries' policymakers often cite. You can read no analysis of that by educator Linda Darling Hammond here. Current standardized tests fall short of student performance in important ways, the summary said. What led teachers to concentrate in class on material that will be on a test, a practice known as teaching to the test? Understanding of untested material can decline, it said. Constraints on testing, including cost and test length, mean that only a subset of material can actually be tested, it said. Thus, test results may give an inflated picture of learning or material that a student is supposed to know. The researchers said that more comprehensive evaluation methods should be developed, but they cautioned that policymakers should not make such an investment at the expense of improvements in other areas of education, including curriculum and instructional methods. Other studies in the past year have also cast doubt on the effectiveness and reliability of the value-added method of teacher-principal evaluation, which takes student test scores and puts them into a formula that is supposed to factor out other influences and determine the value a teacher has brought to a student's learning. The method often ignores outside school factors that can influence how a child does on a test, including lack of sleep, hunger, and illness. But even formulas that are said to take these into account are not especially reliable, some experts have said. So far, state and federal have ignored the evidence. Congress should not. So there you have this article that's full of research that we have paid for, that we ask for from our experts in education, and the research telling us that these tests are not an accurate measure of achievement. And I'm here to tell you that psychologically, they're very bad for the children and the teachers. And what they take away from what that student can get cannot be measured. But we're going to go deeper now into this whole business about testing and find out why testing, why all of this information would be ignored. Why if testing is not really, you know, giving us an answer about how the child is achieving, then why do we continue to use them? Well, I found this very interesting, and I think that you will too, because I hate to use the adage, follow the money, but that's exactly what it looks like. Follow the money and follow the politics, sadly. And this comes from Rethinking Schools. It's on the web at rethinkingschools.org. It's written by Barbara Miner. Keeping public schools public. Testing companies mine for gold. This was in the winter 2004-2005 edition of Rethinking Schools. There's gold in them, their tests. Thanks to the testing mandated by the federal No Child Left Behind legislation, private companies are mining the testing field with all the power their accounts, test makers, and marketeers can muster. States are likely to spend $1.9 billion to $5.3 billion between 2002 and 2008 to implement No Child Left Behind mandated tests, according to the Nonpartisan Government Accounting Office, GAO. Those GAO figures cover just the direct costs of 6 years of developing, scoring, and reporting the test, which is performed under contract with private companies. An indirect cost, such as the amount of classroom teacher time devoted to coordinating and giving the test, and increasingly preparing students with ongoing practice tests, and testing experts say the figure could be 8 to 15 times higher. The amount of education money devoted to standardized tests is only part of the problem. Invariably, the private testing companies that control standardized testing operate behind closed doors with little to no public accountability. They function as subsections of multinational conglomerates that view the U.S. testing industry as just one tentacle of publishing and an entertainment empire that span the globe. There's very little oversight of the testing industry, notes Walt Haney, an education professor at Boston College and a senior researcher at its National Board on Educational Testing and Public Policy. In fact, there is more public oversight of the pet industry and the food we feed our dogs than there is for the quality of tests we make our kids take. Where's the outcry? There has been little public outcry over the fact that private, multinational companies operate beyond public oversight, are determining which students, schools, and districts in the United States are deemed, quote, failures, end quote, and which are deemed, quote, successes, end quote. Given the secrecy that shrouds testing company operations, information is negligible. What the public doesn't know, the public doesn't complain about. Critics of standardized testing also point to a third problem beyond the amount of money and the secrecy. That's the problem of missed opportunity. There's little doubt that the Bush administration's obsession with standardized tests as the sole determinant of school success has undermined reforms that focus on teaching children to think and to do more than fill in circles on test forms. Quote, the amount of money spent on standardized testing is not the real problem, notes Monty Neal, executive director of the Boston-based group Fair Test. The real problem is how it distorts teaching and learning. End quote. The testing explosion. No Child Left Behind, introduced 2 days after George W. Bush took office and passed a year later, instituted an unprecedented level of federal mandates for testing public school students. The mandates, built on bipartisan support for a corporate-influenced agenda of increased standardized testing, but No Child Left Behind carried that agenda to new levels, both with the number of tests and the harsh sanctions for those schools not meeting predetermined levels of test progress. No Child Left Behind requires annual testing of students in 3rd through 8th grades in mathematics and reading or language arts, and testing once in high school. Beginning in 2007 and 8, states will also be required to give tests in science at least once in elementary, middle, and high school. All told, there will be 17 No Child Left Behind tests each year for school districts. This translates into unfathomable amounts of school time devoted to standardized testing and teaching to those tests. It also creates untold business opportunities for the companies that produce the tests. If you add in district and state mandated tests on top of No Child Left Behind requirements and the growing number of practice tests given to students so they will do well on the real tests, the number of tests schools must administer skyrockets. Shrouded in secrecy, ironically, although Bush has used the rhetoric of accountability to justify No Child Left Behind, the finances of the testing companies are almost impossible to uncover. The tests themselves are generally not made public, and mistakes in the test often come to light only when angry parents, students, or school administrators threaten to sue over mistakes in scoring. While the public knows little of the testing companies, lobbyists have ensured that legislators are well aware of those corporate interests. Following Bush's first election and his unveiling of No Child Left Behind, testing company representatives descended on Congress to push it for the type of standardized testing that Bush had made so popular in Texas. I've been lobbying on education issues since 1982, but the test publishers have been active at least at a level I've never seen before. Bruce Hunter of the American Association of School Administrators had said at the time, "At every hearing, every discussion, the big test publishers are always present with at least one lobbyist, sometimes more." And of course, there are the personal connections between the Bush administration and the testing industry. A January 2002 article in The Nation points out that the Bush administration has a particularly cozy relationship with the testing company run by McGraw-Hill. The head of this relationship, the article notes, lies the three-generation school mingling between McGraw and Bush families. The McGraws are old Bush friends, dating back to the 30s. In fact, on the first day he assumed his job at the White House, Bush invited Howard McGraw III into his office, according to The Nation. The testing companies. Three companies have traditionally dominated the market for developing tests: Harcourt Educational Measurement, CTB McGraw-Hill, and Riverside Publishing. All are part of larger conglomerates, and their financial data generally are not reported separately from the controlling corporation. A fourth little-known company, Pearson Educational Measurement, out of Iowa City, Iowa, has significantly increased its market share in recent years. According to the December 1, 2004 Education Week, Pearson has for now overtaken Riverside as the third main testing company. With the testing frenzy engendered by No Child Left Behind, the testing industry is going through a shakeup, and newer companies are competing for state contracts. Some of the newer players, Measured Progress out of Dover, New Hampshire, Data Recognition out of Minnesota, and Educational Testing Services based in Princeton, New Jersey. It's a very competitive landscape right now, and I'd say it's undergoing a fair amount of change, Jeff Galt, president and CEO of Horcart, told Education Week. According to the Education Week survey, CTB McGraw-Hill currently dominates the market and contracts in 23 states. Harcourt Assessment has contracts in 18 states, Pearson in 13, and Riverside in 12. The survey does not indicate the dollar amounts of the contracts or the numbers of students tested. And the article goes on, and I will give you the link to it so that you can go there yourself. But what I think is very important is for you to realize just how much money, and according to how much money is involved in this testing scam. Stephen Krachin, Dr. Stephen Krachin, has said that there is enough money being made in the testing, and you know what's planned is just incredible. Give the children the kind of education that we were giving them when I moved to California. We were second only to New York. You could give an optimum education to these children, and you could also, if you just took this money and bought books with it and libraries and gave it to the teachers so that they could offer a program for the whole child that human growth and development experts have told us is the way to educate children, and Montessori has been telling us for 100 years, and the research just keeps confirming that. And yet we are not going to reflect that in our public education system. We are going to continue to throw money at these tests, which are a scam. We have dumbed down our children. What we have done is just it's so bad. I may sound hysterical to you, but that's because it really is true. And I also know that these same at least McGraw-Hill, does textbooks. And that's another bone of contention with me. All this money to textbooks. Well, we have the computer. We have the net. We can go to the original sources when we are teaching, and we can show the child how to go to the original sources. It is such a scam. So that's further on the testing. Now, I also, in researching this, came across some really wonderful research that some friends had done, and I just became obsessed with it, that the Standard & Poor's, you know, that downgraded our nation's credit, Standard & Poor's is owned by McGraw-Hill. I want to repeat that. Standard & Poor's is owned by McGraw-Hill. Harold McGraw III, the current CEO, worked for George W. Bush, for Dole, for W. Bush, for Cheney, and for Giuliani, and is currently working for Romney 2012. So the person who has downgraded the nation's credit works for Mitt Romney. This is so sick. And then, of course, there is the fact that McGraw-Hill is making tons of money killing our children's minds with these obscene tests. Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of music now and before I move on. Here we go.
Change our lives and past, create ways to redefine the world.
Well, this is Athena Melville, and I'm back, and continue to address public education in America today. These are not the state's children, and most parents don't know that they can opt out of these standardized tests. Schools don't tell them because it would mean a loss of funding. But the children should come first. My gripe with the unions is that they didn't fight this testing crap from day one. That was how they could have supported children and teachers. They compromised on this issue, and it does not speak well for them. However, I am a strong supporter of unions and collective bargaining. And just like I'm a strong supporter of our nation, and I feel we need to fight corruption everywhere. All major media, NPR included, are not presenting the issue of what is happening in education today in a fair and balanced way. We hear nothing on these airwaves from teachers and experts in child growth and development. Only the talking heads in politics and privatization are given the microphone. The charter school controversy is presented in such a bland, black and white way. Understanding what has happened is imperative. When charter schools started out, it was a way to find innovations in education, which is great. It was seized upon by the Christian fundamentalist right as a way of using public funding to form charter schools that would teach religion, passing a law which says there is a separation between church and state. I don't understand, if we have this law, that there is a separation between church and state, how we could give public funds to persons who were starting charter schools that had a definite religious bias. It was also seized upon by mega corporations with wealth, like the Gates Foundation and so many others, to form chains of privatized charter schools using public funding. And it doesn't matter what the intention, not going to the experts in the field of education is what is so disheartening. It's so disheartening that they don't go to these experts that have been trained in education to find solutions. But those great charter schools who really are innovative charter schools and using public funds are addressing the needs of children and their families and have been started by teachers and parents, and they're doing such great work. We need to make distinctions, and the media should be making those distinctions so that you have an informed public, which is the mandate for using the airwaves that we, the people, own. Once again, as Professor Stephen Krachin has said, If you took all the money that they spend on these tests and spent it on the students and on libraries and books, and we truly address the issue of poverty, we could once again have the best system of education for all of America's children. Experts like Jonathan Cozzal, author of Savage Inequalities and The Shame of the Nation, illustrate what education looks like in areas of poverty in this country. Things our nation likes to deny. The work of Alfie Cohen is also monumental in the area of child development and the devastating effects of testing on the young child. It is a form of government-mandated abuse. Well, I'm going to take another short break and give you some music, and when we come back, I'm going to be talking to you about Noam Chomsky, things that are happening in science, public education today, and I'm going to be talking to you about the SOS Save Our Schools Million Teacher March that happened in D.C. over the weekend of July 30th.
Very young, what will you leave us this time? You're only dancing on this earth for a short while, and though your dreams may toss and turn you now, they will vanish away like your daddy's best jeans, denim blue, fading up to the sky. And though you want them to last forever, you know we never will. You know. She's made the goodbye hardest. Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? There'll never be a better chance to change your mind. And if you want this world to see better days, will you carry the words of love with you? Will you ride the great white bird into heaven? And though you want to last forever, you know you never will. You know you never will. And the goodbye makes the journey harder still.
Welcome back. Of course, the tune I played was Cat Stevens' Oh, Very Young. Well, now I'm going to share with you from the transcript from a speech that Noam Chomsky gave called Academic Freedom and the Corporatization of Universities. I'm going to read from the transcript of this amazing lecture, because you'll never hear him speak on mainstream media, not even on NPR, even though he is considered the foremost intellect in this country and really one of the foremost thinkers in the world. So that is why I wanted to share part of this with you, because it's so important and it's so amazing. And it was delivered at the University of Toronto in Scarborough on April 6th, 2011, and you can find it on YouTube, just Noam Chomsky, Academic Freedom and the Corporatization of Universities, and it will come up for you in YouTube. And this transcript of his, you can find if you just Google a transcript for that particular talk. And this is how it begins. A couple of months ago, I went to Mexico to give talks at the National University in Mexico. It's quite an impressive university, hundreds of thousands of students, high quality and engaged students, excellent faculty. It's free. Actually, the government 10 years ago did try to add a little tuition, but there was a national student strike and the government backed off. And in fact, there's still an administrative building on campus that is still occupied by students and used as a center for activism throughout the city. There's also in the city itself another university which is not only free but has open admissions. It has compensatory options for those who need them. I was there, too. It's also quite an impressive level, students, faculty, and so on. That's Mexico, a poor country. Right after that, I happened to go to California, maybe the richest place in the world. I was giving talks at the universities there in California, the main universities, Berkeley and UCLA. They're essentially Ivy League private universities, colossal tuition, tens of thousands of dollars, huge endowment. General assumption is they are pretty soon going to be privatized, and the rest of the system will be, which was a very good system, best public system in the world. That's probably going to be reduced to technical training or something like that. The privatization, of course, means privatization for the rich, and a lower level of mostly technical training for the rest. And that is happening across the country. Next year, for the first time ever, the California system, which was a really great system, best anywhere, is getting more funding from tuition than from the state of California, and that is happening across the country. In most states, tuition covers more than half of the college budget. It's also most of the public research universities, pretty soon only the community colleges, you know, the lowest level of the system, will be state-financed in any serious sense. And even they're under attack. And analysts generally agree, I'm quoting, "The era of affordable four-year public universities, heavily subsidized by the state, may be over." Now that's one important way to implement the policy of the indoctrination of the young. People who are in a debt trap have very few options. Now that is true of social control generally. That is also a regular feature of international policy. Those of you who study the IMF and the World Bank and others are well aware. As the Mexico-California example illustrates, the reasons for conscious destruction of the greatest public education system in the world are not economic. Economist Doug Henwood points out that it would be quite easy to make higher education completely free. In the U.S., it accounts for less than 2% of gross domestic product. The personal share, about 1% of gross domestic product, is a third of the income of the richest 10,000 households. That's the same as 3 months of Pentagon spending. It's less than 4 months of wasted administrative costs of the privatized healthcare system, which is an international scandal. It's about twice the per capita cost of comparable countries, has some of the worst outcomes, and in fact, it's the basis for the famous deficit. If the U.S. had the same kind of healthcare system as other industrial countries, not only would there be no deficit, but there would be a surplus. However, to introduce these facts into an electoral campaign would be suicidally insane, Henwood points out. Now, he's correct. In a democracy where elections are essentially bought by concentrations of private capital, it doesn't matter what the public wants. The public has actually been in favor of that for a long time, but they are irrelevant in a properly run democracy. We should recall that the great growth period in the economy, the U.S. economy, was in the several decades after World War II, commonly called the Golden Age by economists. It was substantially fueled by affordable public education and by university research. Affordable public education induces the GI Bill. Includes the GI Bill, which provided free education for veterans. And remember, that was a much poorer country than today. Extremely low tuition was found even at private colleges. Actually, I went to an Ivy League college, and it cost $100 a year. That's more now, but it's not that high. It's not $30,000 or $40,000, you know. What about university-based research? Well, as I mentioned, that is the core of the modern high-tech economy. That includes computers, the internet, in fact, the whole IT revolution, and a whole lot more. The dismantling of this system since the 1970s is among the many moves toward a very sharply two-tiered society, a very narrow concentration of wealth and stagnation for most everyone else. It also has a direct economic consequence. Take, say, California. What they are doing to the public education system is going to undermine the economy that relies on a skilled workforce and creative innovation. Silicon Valley and so on, well apart from the enormous human cost of depriving people of decent educational opportunities, these policies undermine U.S. competitive capacity. That's very harmful to the mass of the population, but it doesn't matter to the tiny percent of concentrated wealth and power. In fact, in the years since the Powell Memorandum, we've entered into a new stage in state capitalism in which the future just doesn't amount to much. Profit comes increasingly from financial manipulations. The corporate policies are geared toward short-term profit, and that reduces the concern for loyalty to a firm over a longer stretch. We'll talk about this more, he says, tomorrow, because he's going to have a question and answer with them. And he says, but right now, let me talk about the consequences for education, which are quite significant. Again, I'm reading from a transcript of a lecture delivered by Noam Chomsky on April 6th of 2011. Suppose, as it increasingly happens, not only in the United States, incidentally, that universities are not funded by the state, meaning the general community. So how are the universities going to survive? Universities are parasitic institutions. They don't produce commodities for profit, thankfully. They may one of these days. The funding issue raises many troubling questions, which would not arise if fostering independent thought and inquiry were regarded as a public good, having intrinsic value. That's the traditional idea of the universities. Although there are major efforts to change that, take Britain. According to the British press, the Arts and Humanities Research Council was just ordered to spend a significant amount of funding on the Prime Minister's vision for the country, his so-called big society, which means big corporate profits and the rest look out for themselves. The government produces what they call a clarification of the famous Haldane principle. That's the century-old principle that barred such government intrusion into academic research. If this stands, which I think is kind of hard to believe, but if it stands, the hand of Big Brother will rest quite heavily on inquiry and innovation in the arts and humanities as the masters of mankind follow the advice of the Powell Memorandum, of course, defending academic freedom in ways that would receive nods of approval from those who must not be named, borrowing my grandchildren's rhetoric. Cameron's Britain is seeking to take the lead on the assault on public education. The rest of the Western world is not far behind. In some ways, the U.S. is ahead. More generally, in a corporate-run culture, the traditional idea of free and independent thought may be given lip service, but other values tend to rank higher. Defending the authentic institutional freedom is no small task, however, is not hopeless by any means. I'll talk about the case I know best at my own university. It is a very striking case because of the nature of its funding. Technically, it's a private university, but it has vast state funding, overwhelming, particularly since the Second World War. When I joined the faculty over 55 years ago, there were military jobs. Since then, they've been technically severed. The academic programs, too, at that time, in the 50s, were almost entirely funded by the Pentagon. Under student pressure in the time of troubles, the 60s, there were protests about this and calls for investigation. A faculty-student commission was formed in 69 to investigate the matter. I was a member, thanks in part to student pressure. The commission was interested. It found that despite the funding source, the Pentagon, almost the entire academic program, there was no military-related work on campus except in the sense that virtually anything can have some military application. Actually, there was an exception to this. The political science department was deeply engaged in the Vietnam War under the guise of peace research. Since that time, Pentagon funding has been deadening. And funding from health-related state institutions, National Institute of Health, and so on, that's been increasing. There's a reason for that. It's reflecting change in the economy. In the 50s and 60s, the cutting edge of the economy was electronic space. The Pentagon was a natural way to steal money from the taxpayers, making them think they're being protected from the Russians or somebody, and to direct it to eventual corporate profits. That was done very effectively. It induces computers. I mean, it includes computers, the internet, the IT revolution. In fact, most of the modern high-tech economy came from that. In most recent years, the economy is being more biology-based. Therefore, state funding is shifting. 50 years ago, if you looked around MIT, you would have found small electronic setups from the faculty. They were drawing on Pentagon funding for research, and if they were successful, they were brought up by major corporations. Those of you who know something about the high-tech economy will know that that's the famous Route 128. That was 50 years ago. Now if you go around the campus, the startups are biology-based, and the same process continues. Genetic engineering, biotechnology, pharmaceuticals. The big buildings going up are Novartis and so on. That's the way the so-called free enterprise economy works. There's also been a shift to more short-term applied work. The Pentagon and the National Institute of Health are concerned with the long-term future of the advanced economy. In contrast, a business firm typically wants something that it can use, and not its competitors in tomorrow. I don't actually know of a careful study, but it seems pretty clear that the shift toward corporate funding is leading towards more short-term applied research and less exploration of what might turn out to be interesting and important down the road. Another consequence of corporate funding is more secrecy. This surprises a lot of people, but during the period of Pentagon funding, there was no secrecy. There was also no security on campus. You may remember this. You could walk into the Pentagon-funded labs 24 hours a day, and no cards to stick into things and so on. No secrecy. It was all entirely open. There is secrecy today. A corporation can't compel secrecy, but they can make it very clear that you're not going to get your contract renewed if your work leaks to others. That has happened, in fact. It's led to some scandals, some big enough to appear on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Outside funding has other effects on the university. Unless it's free and unconstrained, observing the Haldane principle. Indeed, it has been true to a significant degree of funding from the Pentagon and the other national institutions. However, any kind of outside funding, even keeping to the Haldane principle, suppose it establishes a teaching or research facility that automatically shifts the balance of academic activity and that can threaten the independence and integrity of the institution, and in the case of corporate funding, quite severely. Corporatization can have considerable influence in other ways. Corporate managers have a duty. They have to focus on profit-making and seeking to convert as many of much of life as possible into commodities. It's not because they're bad people. It's their task. Under Anglo-American law, it's their legal obligation as well. There's a lot to say about this topic, but one element of it concerns the universities and much else. One particular consequence is the focus on what's called efficiency. It's an interesting concept. It's not strictly an economic concept. It has crucial ideological dimensions. If a business reduces personnel, it might become more efficient by standard measures with lower costs. Typically, that shifts the burden to the public, a very familiar phenomenon we see all the time. Costs to the public are not counted, and they're colossal. That's a choice that's not based on economic theory. That's based on an ideological decision which applies directly to the business model, as they're called, of the universities. Increasing class size or employing cheap temporary labor, say graduate students instead of full-time faculty, may look good on a university budget, but there are significant costs. They're transferred to students and to the society generally, as the quality of education, the quality of instruction is lowered. There is, furthermore, no way to measure the human and social costs of converting schools and universities into facilities that produce commodities for the job market, abandoning the traditional idea of the universities, fostering creative and independent thought and inquiry, challenging perceived beliefs, exploring new horizons, and forgetting external constraints. That's an idea that's no doubt been flawed in practice, but to the extent that it's realized, is a good measure of the level of civilization has achieved. That idea is being challenged very openly by Adam Smith's principal architects of policy in the state corporate complex, the direct attack on the Haldane principle in Britain. That's an extreme case. In fact, so extreme I assume it may be beaten back. There are less blatant examples. Many of them are just inherent in the reliance on outside funding, state or private. These are two sources that are not easy to distinguish given the control of the state by private interest. So what's the right reaction to outside funding that threatens the ideal of free university? Well, one choice is just to reject it in principle, in which case the university would go down the tubes. It's a parasitic institution. Another choice is to recognize it as a fact of life, that when I'm at work, I have to walk past the Lockheed Martin Lecture Hall, and I have to look out my office window at the Koch building, which is named after the multi-billionaires who are the major funders of the Tea Party and a leading force in ongoing campaigns to wipe out the remnants of the labor movement and to institute a kind of corporate tyranny. Now, if that outside funding seeks to influence teaching, research, and other activities, then there's a strong argument that it should simply be resisted or rejected outright, no matter what the cost. Such influences are not inevitable, and that's worth bearing in mind. And there you have Chomsky's wonderful lecture given this April 6th, 2011, and called Academic Freedom and the Corporatization of Universities. And you can find it at on the YouTube by just asking for Noam Chomsky, Academic Freedom and the Corporatization of Universities. Well, I'm going to take another break right here, and I hope you're enjoying this, and I'll be back with you shortly.
Look for God and life and distant planets. Have your faith in the ever after, while each of us holds inside the map to the labyrinth. And heaven's here on earth. peace and love and understanding. This could be heaven here on earth.
Well, it's time to wind down. And, of course, that was just Tracy Chapman that you heard singing Heaven's Here on Earth. And some of the things that we're not going to get to in this podcast, because I just don't have time, but I'll tell you about them, is that science in public education today, of course, it's such a sad story. Evolution, of course, constantly being challenged. And now there's a great article called The Lynch Mob Hate Against Climate Science by Chris Mooney. And you can get it if you just Google The Lynch Mob Hate Against Climate Science. Chris Mooney, ChrisMooney. And it tells a really sad story of what is happening in science and what climate science teachers are having to go through, really science in general, in this country right now, in teaching public schools. Our first radio podcast launch in September is on Thursday, the 1st of September. And we're going to continue our focus on public education. Our guest will be Donna Yates Mace, a teacher from the Duval County Public Schools in Florida. And she may have a team with her. We'll see if it's just Donna or a group. And Donna was one of a number of persons who worked for the SOS Million Teacher March, the Save Our Schools Million Teacher March in D.C., which took place on the weekend of July 30th of this year. Jonathan Cozzal was a keynote speaker, as well as Matt Damon. And right now, there is a letter campaign to NPR going on by parents across America who are asking people to sign their petition protesting the coverage of the SOS March on NPR. So if you would just go to the website, Parents Across America, PARENTSACROSSAMERICA.org. And you will find the letter there that they're asking people to sign that they are sending to NPR for the terrible coverage of the march, of the SOS Million Teachers March, and who they had on to talk about it. Not one teacher, not one expert in the field of child growth and development. Absolutely pathetic. I want to thank you for listening to Education Now. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. All broadcasts and podcasts can be heard with free download at this website. Education Now broadcasts and podcasts are listed on the American Montessori Society website at 3wsams.org. That's 3wsamshq.org. Look under the local events page. And please, please support the teachers and the parents. The lack of respect for those who are entrusted with the care and education of our nation's children is so very painful to watch. And the attack on collective bargaining is also very painful to watch. Take action, speak out, and follow the child. This is your host, Athena Melville, saying goodbye for now.
must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you love.